From the Moan Broadcast Center at KPCC, this is The Frame. I'm John Horn. Today's show is all about the Academy Award nominations. First, we'll break down this year's picks with Kyle Buchanan of The New York Times. Then we have two of the lead actress nominees, including Cynthia Erivo, who plays the abolitionist Harriet Tubman in Harriet.
I liked the uncomfortability of the work that I was doing because I felt like it made me, I guess it gave me the space to be more connected to her, connected to what she may have gone through.
We'll also hear from the star of Judy, Renee Zellweger, and the composer of Joker, one of the few women ever nominated for film scoring. It's The Frame. We'll be right back. Welcome to The Frame. I'm John Horn. It's Academy Award nominations morning, so we're out in the field. We're in the Los Feliz Bureau of the New York Times with a carpetbagger, Kyle Buchanan. Kyle, I brought a muffin. Thanks for having us over this morning.
Yes, I'm eagerly consuming that muffin. I need all the sustenance I can get after today's crack of dawn Oscar nominations.
We have both been up since very early this morning, and even though I think we're still relatively awake and conscious, I still think these nominations don't make a lot of sense. So where do you want to start? Let's talk about the movies that didn't get any love. I was shocked that The Farewell did not make it into the Best Picture race and that no actors from The Farewell or Parasite were nominated.
Yeah, I loved The Farewell, which came out this past summer. I would have loved to see Awkwafina or Zhao Shuzhen, who plays her grandmother in that movie, get in. Unfortunately, yeah, it just missed out on everything. A24, which distributed The Farewell, it's a very hip indie studio, but they haven't shown an ability to get any of their summer movies ever into the Oscar race in a major way. They had the same problem with Eighth Grade and First Reformed last year, and now The Farewell. Meanwhile, though, you've got Neon, sort of comparable to A24, which got Parasite 6 Oscar nominations.
No, and Parasite is not only nominated for Best Picture, it's also up for Best International Feature and Best Director for Bong Joon-ho. If it wins the Best Picture prize, and I got to say, it has a shot, it will become the first foreign language movie to win that top prize. But let's look a little bit more closely at who didn't make the cut. So Bong Joon-ho was nominated for director. Greta Gerwig wasn't. And Todd Phillips was for Joker. Joker had the most nominations with 11. How do we start to talk about Joker?
Well, I don't know. I feel like we will never stop talking about Joker is the thing. It's been that sort of movie since the beginning, since it was announced, since people got wind of its themes, and especially since it became a billion-dollar grosser at the box office, which is crazy for a movie that, yes, is about a famous comic book character, but it doesn't have action scenes. It's grim. It's upsetting. And now it's a Best Picture and Best Director nominee. Is it going to win those awards? I don't think so. Maybe I'm protecting myself from thinking so. I do think, though, that Joaquin Phoenix is a near lock for Best Actor.
One of the first acting nominations that was announced this morning was for Best Supporting Actress, Kathy Bates in Richard Jewell. I don't think anybody saw that nomination coming, and it did seem to suggest what was going to happen for the next 19 acting nominees, and that is only one person of color, Cynthia Erivo, who played Harriet Tubman, was going to get a nomination.
Yes, and no shade to Kathy Bates, but the fact that she made it in and Jennifer Lopez didn't for Hustlers, I think that's one of the biggest stories of this morning. I personally loved Hustlers. I thought Jennifer Lopez was giving a fantastic, robust movie star performance in that film. For some reason, well, for a couple reasons, it just did not seem to catch on as far as that award season recontextualization that needs to happen when you've got a big hit and then you want to prove that you're more than just a hit. The Academy, with the exception of Little Women this year, turned an awfully cold shoulder to female ensembles and female directors, for that matter. There's quite a few nominated in Best Documentary, but almost nowhere else, including the big Best Director category. It bothers me that I feel like stories that are made by women, that star women, are not afforded the same sort of canonical weight. We so easily give similar stories about men.
We're talking with Kyle Buchanan from the New York Times about today's Oscar nominations. when I was at the LA Times before I came to KPCC, I, along with a team of reporters, spent a year investigating the membership of the Academy. At that time, we found that it was 94% Caucasian. The median age was 62. It was 77% male. In the years since, and certainly on the heels of the hashtag #OscarSoWhite, the Academy has gone to incredible steps to try to diversify its membership. But the Academy, like the mafia, you're in for life. Do you think the voting today really represents that older demographic in the kind of reluctance to embrace anything outside of Parasite that feels like a modern movie?
Well, I think that's the thing about the Oscars, and that's the reason we keep talking about it every year. They make steps forward, they make steps backward. It is a big organization, several thousand people. So as much as you diversify it, there will be diverse opinions. You know, last year we had Oscar history with a film like Black Panther, where it won best costume design, best production design, first time a black woman had won those things. You also had Green Book win, which many considered to be sort of retrograde racial issues claptrap. I think the Academy is big enough to be able to sustain both of those points of view.
And it's worth noting, too, that the Academy doesn't really run the business in any way. It is only recognizing the movies that are getting made and the jobs that are being given by people who run Hollywood. Today, LA Mayor Eric Garcetti unveiled an initiative to try to promote Latinx talent. He hopes to double Latino representation in Hollywood by 2030. But what is it going to take for the industry to start making more diverse films so that the Oscars can recognize more diverse films?
Well, the Oscars don't make movies, but they affect the movies that get made. And I think it's important to talk about that because this is sort of a cycle where all of these things feed each other. Movies that are greenlit, movies that are cast with certain people or made by certain people, they're made that way often because of what we are told is important by the Oscars. As much as the Oscars sort of say, well, we can only do so much given the films that Hollywood gives us, Hollywood gave them plenty of amazing films this year that were sort of disregarded out of hand, I think, because we don't, again, ascribe the same weight to certain stories outside of white men doing violent, dramatic, weighty things.
Kyle Buchanan is the carpetbagger at the New York Times. Kyle, thanks for having us over to the Los Feliz Bureau of the New York Times.
I'm glad you guys could come.
Up next on The Frame, we hear from Oscar nominees Cynthia Erivo and Renee Zellweger. Welcome back to The Frame. I'm John Horn. British actress Cynthia Erivo is an Academy Award nominee for her performance in Harriet, and she's the only person of color among this year's 20 acting nominees. The movie, directed and co-written by Casey Lemons, tells the story of how Harriet Tubman escaped from slavery and became a heroic abolitionist. When I spoke with Erivo about playing Tubman, I asked her how shooting in Virginia during a cold autumn helped her get into character.
It was sort of imperative for me to try and do as much as I possibly could, as authentically as I could do it. So I sort of opted out of the wetsuit, opted out of any like extra warming things whilst I was doing the activities, just because I didn't want to. I didn't want to feel comfortable, really. I liked the uncomfortability of the work that I was doing because I felt like it made me. I guess it gave me the space to be more connected to her, connected to what she may have gone through, so that the reaction was genuine and it felt real. So yeah, I do think it really helps in doing all of these actions to be more connected to the story.
Not every actor gets to co-write his or her theme song, but Cynthia, you wrote a song called Stand Up with Joshua Campbell.
Yeah. I've been walking with my face turned to the sun. Weight on my shoulders.
I mean, music is, I like to think, is my second language, so I use it a lot to communicate, to tell stories. I write my own music, so it means I get to speak the things that I probably couldn't speak out loud through music. And so to get the chance to, I guess, use my voice for her, move myself out the way and find a voice that felt right for Harriet to use in the purest sense for communication was really special. And where we were, it just felt like it was a little bit like hallowed ground. We were on a plantation, so to be able to sing those spirituals for people, to call to people, felt really empowering and special. And I hope that it plays a huge role for people to understand what the story is about, to understand what these people were going through, because I feel like there's no purer way to communicate with anyone. To I feel like when you sing, you expose yourself completely, and in doing that, in this, I hope that that's what people have seen. You know, a person who is exposed and whose heart is on their sleeve and who is trying to communicate something they cannot say.
We're talking with Cynthia Erivo, who plays Harriet Tubman in the film. I want to play a clip from the movie. This is a scene where Harriet is talking with William Still, who is played by Leslie Odom Jr.
Rescuing slaves requires skill and careful planning. It requires reading, Harriet. Can you read a sign or a map? Can you read it all?
I put my attention on trying to hear God's voice more clearly.
Do you know what would happen if you got caught? They would torture you until you pointed them right to this office. You got lucky, Harriet. And there's nothing more you can do.
Don't you tell me what I can't do. I made it this far on my own. God was watching, but my feet was my own. Running, bleeding, climbing, nearly drowned, nothing to eat for days and days, man. I made it. So don't you tell me what I can't do.
That could be a woman in 2019. And obviously, Harriet Tubman is an African-American slave, but this is as contemporary as any movie can be.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. I think it was the most important thing for me was really about trying to bring her to life. You know, people don't know that she had emotions and she had feelings and she could get angry and she could, you know, be joyous and heartbroken, all of those things that we as humans experience. And so I wanted to be as fully emotionally available as I possibly could, so that those feelings are real. We feel them. I felt them. The idea that someone tells you you can't do something and you're like, I know I can do something. I know I can do it. So I don't need you telling me that I can't. And, you know, it just felt like one of the most... That was definitely a scene I was looking forward to shooting, because it felt like it was so connected to the real world where I was in my time, which is kind of cool.
That was Cynthia Erivo. She actually earned 2 Oscar nominations today for her work in the film Harriet, one for lead actress and another for co-writing the original song titled Stand Up. Renee Zellweger also was nominated in the lead actress category. In the movie Judy, she plays Judy Garland. Directed by Rupert Gould, the film tells the story of how the singer battled a variety of demons while performing shows in a London nightclub in 1969, near the end of her troubled life.
You made me love you. I didn't want to do it. I didn't want to do it.
Zellweger sings in the film, but says she didn't worry about mimicking Garland's iconic voice.
And I tried not to think about that, and I'm still trying not to think about that, because I know that that wasn't what Rupert was trying to achieve with this. It was more about her humanity, an opportunity to capture the essence of this extraordinary woman and contextualize the experiences of her life in that period of her life.
What's the matter?
Ladies and gentlemen,
I can't. What? No. What do you mean you can't? There's an audience out there waiting to hear you sing.
My mouth dry and it could fall apart.
Listen to me. I can't. You'll be fine. Now, on you go.
There was a fascinating review that we found of the original concerts in 1968 in The Observer. Mm-hmm. And this is what the critics said in part. She doesn't really give a concert. She conducts a seance. She evokes pity and sorrow like no other superstar.
Wow.
So, and that seems to fit really into the movie about what's going on in Judy's life at the time of this story. So how would you describe the chaos mm-hmm. that is all around her and how that chaos starts to show itself on stage when she's performing.
I mean, this is her bliss. We're talking about performance and connecting with audiences, and obviously it's her gift, and it's also what she relies on for her freedom and financial stability and her ability to take care of herself. She was in debt, and she didn't have a home, a place to live. She was having difficulty finding work in the United States because her reputation was not one of great reliability. And then there's this addiction that we didn't, I guess, well, we understand a little bit more about these days, obviously, coupled with anxieties and, you know, just years and years and years of overworking this thing that you're supposed to take very great care of, which I've come to learn about this instrument that you can't just push and push and push. The chaos, I suppose, is just, you know, what you see on the outside is usually a manifestation of what's on the inside. And all of those things, one of those things that she was experiencing at the time would have been enough to break a person. And I think that that's what's so interesting about talking about this time in her life. It's not, I don't think that there's any shame in it. I think that it just really highlights how exceptional she was, that she was able to overcome all of this mess and still perform and still give so much to her audiences. And despite the abuse and the wear on her instrument, boy, she still delivered, you know? She still could hit those notes and break your heart like nobody.
The other thing that I think is really interesting about the film is Judy Garland had addiction issues, but those addiction issues were started by Hollywood. Mm-hmm. That she was punished and treated in ways that were almost, I think, are inhumane in terms of the way the studio treated her, the way they talked about her weight, what she couldn't eat, how she had to be on medication. And that feels like a central idea to the film, that this is not a woman who is making choices in her own life. Those choices were made for her before she had any agency.
That's true. And obviously, obviously it's going to change your body chemistry and create a situation where you can't function without whatever it was that they were giving you to help you deliver on such a crazy schedule, you know? And that's another thing I think is interesting. It sort of puts in context that this was not a choice. This is not a person who wakes up in the morning and wants a handful of pills because she just doesn't feel like dealing with the day. This is a woman who would have seizures if she overslept and woke up having, you know, not having her medication. It's tragic in that respect, but again, when you look at what she was capable of in spite of all of that and the lack of understanding around her about what that means and what you might do to treat it as we better understand today.
Yeah. I mean, I think the people who are most willing to enable her were the people who are most able to make a profit off of her.
Right. And I don't even know that it's as nefarious as that. I don't know that people were thinking, well, we know the cost of this and we don't care. I think it was ignorance all the way around. This was helpful. This was helpful because it made her feel better and it helped her need less sleep and she could get through these grueling days with all of these numbers. And I'm not sure that they knew what it was that they were doing in terms of launching this ship to sail down this path for a lifetime.
That was Renee Zellweger. She was nominated for an Oscar today for playing Judy Garland in Judy. Up next on The Frame, Hildur Gunnarsdottir wrote the music for Joker, and she became only the 9th woman ever nominated in the music scoring categories. Welcome back to The Frame. I'm John Horn. The honor for the most Academy Award nominations today went to Joker, which received 11 picks, including Best Picture, Director for Todd Phillips, and Actor for Joaquin Phoenix. Also nominated was the film's score. The music was composed by Iceland's Hildur Gunnarsdottir, who's having a breakout year. She won an Emmy for her music on HBO's Chernobyl, and today Gunnarsdottir became only the 9th woman ever nominated in the music scoring categories. She recently spoke with The Frame's Jonathan Shiflett.
My name is Hildur Gunnarsdottir, and I am the cellist and composer for the film Joker. I experience music very physically. as I read the script, I have a kind of physical reaction to the story, and it was kind of very focused on the chest area and the hand movements. And then they used a lot of the music whilst they were shooting, and it was just, there was one scene in particular that was just incredible to see how Joaquin, without us talking about it at all, like I had no dialogue with him about it, but he did exactly the same movements that I was feeling as I wrote the original themes. It was just such a magical process. I thought it was really important to kind of feel like we were like in his head, and it's really close to him. It's all kind of his inner landscape, basically, the music. It doesn't really underscore much, but it's just like really kind of present as his inner character. And that's kind of what I was trying to do with the instrumentation of, like, in the beginning of the film, it's almost like you're listening just to one instrument playing. But at the same time, there's this kind of huge energy. Like, there's actually like 100 people playing these, like some of these melodies, but you can almost not hear them. They're almost like this kind of hidden energy that's like his aggression. And the feeling of this kind of underlying something is about to kind of burst from out of the from out of the shadows. And just like, it was hard to have like 100 people like not just playing on full blast all the time, because you're like, whoa! So it was a bit of a constraint for people basically not to play and not to make any sound. So it was like really interesting energy in the room. So the recording process is really important to me. It's not only the performance itself, but like how the recordings are. Because I used to work as an engineer as well. And so I always feel like working with microphones almost as instruments. It was really important that it wasn't just like a full orchestra with like, you know, classical miking positions, but it was also like a lot of close miking and a lot of like contact mics and different like mic placements that we were working with during those recordings. Contact mics are wonderful. Wonderful pieces of equipment, because it's almost like having a microscopic lens on a sound, and you can go really, really, really close. With string instruments, you can really feel the wood, and you can really feel the texture of the actual instrument and the breath of it. You're not just like... I guess it's kind of like if you imagine what it would be like being inside somebody's vocal cords as they're speaking. You know, instead of being in a room with someone and listening from outside, you're really like, you get to go inside of a sound. The themes kind of, you know, stay largely the same, but the orchestration and the, you know, and the size and the scope and the kind of heaviness of the music just kind of gets larger as he's kind of, you know, just getting more frustrated and more aggressive, and then in the end he just like explodes. Well, to me it felt a bit like when you're stuck in the same tracks and you're just like, you know, you're just like, oh, I'm trying to get there, oh, I'm trying to get there, oh, I'm trying to, oh, you're still kind of doing the same movement, or you're kind of really just getting more and more frustrated, but you don't really move anywhere. That's kind of what I experienced with him. I was just like, oh, turn, you know. I wasn't there for the very beginning of the shooting, but I came to the set, you know, just to say hello and you know, just to kind of, you know, catch a glimpse of the set, and they had been listening to the same pieces of music like again and again and again for probably 2 months at this time, and I actually didn't know that they had been playing the music the whole time. So I kind of arrived and I'm kind of like, you know, walking with the walls because I didn't want to disturb anyone. And then Todd introduced me to everyone, and I just got this like massively warm welcome. Like, oh my God, it's the composer. And I was like, well, how did they know? So I would have expected them to be sick of it, but they were still pretty happy to see me, seemingly so.
Smile, though your heart is aching.
That was Hildur Gunnadottir, who composed the score for Joker. And as of today, she's an Academy Award nominee. We'll hear from many more of the nominees in the days and weeks to come. The Oscar ceremony will be held on February 9th. And that is it for today. Remember, you can follow us on Facebook and Twitter. We are at The Frame. I'm John Horn. Thanks for listening. We're back here tomorrow at the Moen Broadcast Center.
And maybe